And tonight on Coast to Coast AM, we are going to talk about ESP. We're going to talk about the ESP enigma. Dr. Diane Hennessy-Powell back with us on Coast to Coast AM, and we'll get right to it when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Dr. Diane Powell, author, public speaker, researcher, a practicing psychiatrist, trained and worked with some of the best minds of the century in biophysics, neuroscience, anthropology, genetics at Johns Hopkins University's School of Medicine. Now, her research interests include the neuroscience of extraordinary states of human consciousness and anomalous experiences. And here she is back on Coast to Coast. Diane, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. You remind me of my late aunt, who was a psychiatrist who gave up her practice to investigate ESP. I'm almost almost identical. Almost.
Really?
Dr. Shafika Karegula, she wrote a book called Breakthrough to Creativity.
Uh-huh.
And that was it. She was obsessed with it. And she knew some of the great minds of her day, like you.
That's fascinating.
Yep.
That's fascinating.
What made you switch like that? Not that you've switched totally.
Well, it was actually after I had become a psychiatrist. And as a psychiatrist, I had been trained, as psychiatrists are, that if someone says that they can read other people's minds, or that other people are reading their mind, or that they can affect objects at a distance, or anything like that, that it was a sign that they were psychotic and in need of antipsychotic medication, of course. And that's what I was trained with. But there was a time when I saw a patient when I was at Harvard, and I was the assistant director of their consultation liaison service. So I went over to their medical floors if there was a problem. If they thought a patient had a mental illness, they would call me over, for example. And you can't leave the hospital against medical advice if you are deemed to be insane. And so this woman had been admitted with the symptoms of a heart attack, and she wanted to leave the hospital. So when I went in to see her, she said that the reason why she wanted to leave was that she knew the test would come back normal because she was psychic.
Mm-hmm.
And besides that, she was seeing all these spirits that had died in the hospital. And
and you're going, okay.
Yeah. Right. I mean, that's most psychiatrists at that point would have said, okay, yeah, the staff are right. This woman isn't in her sane mind. And they would have signed the paperwork and forced her to stay. Instead, I sat down and I talked with her, and I wanted to know a little bit more about what she meant when she said she was psychic. And she told me she didn't do it for a living, that she cleaned for a living, and that she just did it for friends and family. And then she all of a sudden said, I'm getting a really strong reading from you. Can I tell you what I see?
It's like a role reversal all of a sudden, huh?
Exactly. I thought I was there to evaluate her, and
yeah.
All of a sudden, she starts to tell me things. And one of the things she said to me, one of the first things she said to me is, she said, your husband's a chemist, and my husband was an MD, PhD, and his PhD was in biochemistry.
I love it.
And she said, and right now he's applying for a job in two different cities, which was true. That very week he was going to be flying out to San Diego to apply for a position, and he was also looking at going back to Johns Hopkins.
So now you're interested at this point.
Yes,
right?
Now I'm interested.
Yeah.
And so, but I didn't want her to know how interested, so I just played it cool, and I just said, oh, well, if that were the case, what cities would they be? And she said, name off some cities, and I'll tell you. And so I named off 10, 12 cities, and she said, San Diego.
The first one. Boom.
Well, that wasn't the first one that I named. I named off about 10 or 12 cities.
Right, but I mean, that was her first pick. Bang.
That was her pick, and yeah. Guess, I didn't even know where I was going to end up at that point. She said, in your husband's heart of heart, he really wants to go to one place, but you'll end up at the other place. And in my husband's heart of hearts, he wanted to go back to Baltimore. That's where we met. That's where he was, 13th generation Baltimorean.
Uh-huh.
So I knew that's where he wanted to go, but we ended up in San Diego.
How about that?
And she then also told me that I would leave psychiatry to write books, and that I'd have a daughter, and several other things. And so some of the things she told me were things that I already knew were either going on or had happened. But as each year passed and I saw that the prediction she made about the future came true, I just became more and more fascinated by it.
Did you keep in touch with her, Diane?
I wish that I had. I really wish that I had. What I did do, though, which is what a lot of psychiatrists would not have done, is that I told her that if she wanted to leave the hospital, I wouldn't force her to stay.
After that session, you couldn't, you know?
Exactly. And I came out to the nursing station, and they said, are you going to sign the paperwork? And I said, no. And are you going to put her on an antipsychotic? I said, no. But she agreed to stay anyway. She liked me, and she wanted to see me the next day. And so she ended up staying, and her tests were normal, and she went home.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Did you ever find out how she had this ability?
She told me that she was born, she was half Native American and half African American. And she told me that she was born with basically a caul over her face, which is like some of the afterbirth.
Yes.
And that she had been told that people who were born with that have psychic abilities. And so that's where she believes her ability came from. And I find that fascinating as a neuroscientist because of the fact that so many people who have psychic abilities develop them after some kind of experience, such as a near-death experience or an accident. So it's fascinating that head trauma, oxygen deprivation at birth, things like that can actually increase your chances of having these experiences.
So was she then, did she end up being the catalyst for you to truly go into this field of studying extrasensory perception, consciousness?
She was, but I was underground about it. I was just sort of just on my own.
Like a hobby?
Yeah, like a hobby. Only all of my hobbies I take very seriously.
Yeah, me too.
And what happened was is I became a part of a think tank at La Jolla at the Salk Institute, and there were a lot of people there, famous neuroscientists, people like V.S. Ramachandran, and there were people like Francis Crick and Fred Gage, and people who were hardcore Nobel laureate neuroscientists as well as other scientists, biochemists. And I saw that these brilliant people, when they talked about consciousness, it was as though we were back in the days of thinking the earth was flat. And I the more I experienced the, as I said, in my practice, I listened to my patients, and after that patient, I became more and more interested in other patients' reports of what they experienced. And so the more I learned about what human consciousness is capable of and was thinking about the model that neuroscientists were operating under, I realized that they were barking up the wrong tree.
What was it that finally got you to go public with this?
I think first of all, well, what happened was is that I have a brother who is a physicist, and he's a brilliant physicist who's interested in consciousness and something that we talked about over the years. And I had turned him on to this conference that occurs every other year in Arizona at the University of Arizona on science and consciousness. And they have an international conference the years that they're not in Arizona. And there was a conference coming up in Copenhagen. And my brother said to me, here it is, it's November, and the due date for the abstract to speak at the conference. And mind you, I hadn't spoken about any of this at all in public. I had 3 weeks to get the abstract in, and here it is, the holidays, and I have all of the things that you have to do during the holidays. And my brother said, I'm gonna submit one, and why don't you? And wouldn't that be fun? And I just thought, okay. And I thought, well, if I'm going to talk about these abilities that I've been studying at a scientific conference like this, the place to start would be to talk about autistic savants, because savants have these abilities that scientists don't disagree exist. They just don't understand how they do it. They don't dispute the fact that you have, for example, this set of twins that Oliver Sacks talked about, who can spit out prime numbers back and forth, just like people can toss, you know, you say a word that starts with A and I'll say a word that starts with A, that game, you know, they can do that with prime numbers in the 6-7 digits. And prime numbers, there really isn't a good algorithm for prime numbers. They're not calculating prime numbers. The prime numbers just come to them.
I mean, it's like reading the phone book, isn't it? Where they just know everything?
They just they know what they pay that they're interested in. Yes. So people who there are some people who become fascinated by the phone book, and they can tell you everything that's in the phone book. And these aren't even. I mean, it's they could just recite, you know, from front to back.
All the names.
New York City phone book.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's
right.
Name, address, phone number. And so that capacity for memory, I mean, is phenomenal about autistic savants. But this goes beyond fantastic memory. This is how do they? These are people who couldn't attend school and take regular math because they have a disability.
Or even function, you know, in day-to-day activities, right?
Right, right, exactly. Tie their shoes.
Yeah.
Or even give change. Go to the store and buy something and give change.
Right, things that we would take for granted.
Things that we
they
take
couldn't
for granted.
Do.
Yeah, they couldn't do. And yet these prime numbers would just come to them. And so, to me, that's something that is as remarkable as ESP. In fact, I mean, why put it into a different category? The reason for putting it into a different category is because ESP has all of this taboo in science.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I thought, I'll talk about autistic savants and their abilities at this conference in Copenhagen. And so I wrote an abstract about it, and it got accepted. And I gave a talk, and it was overflowing and received high praise. And several people there at the conference said, you are going to continue in this, aren't you?
Well, first of all, people need people like you in this in this field, because there aren't enough professionals who stick their neck out to do this.
Right. Right. Exactly. Exactly. I really feel I feel the duty as a scientist. And I have a very, very curious mind. And one of the things that's missing in science today is that they're beating the open-mindedness and the curiosity out of scientists in the way that they're training them in this country.
Well, there's no doubt about that.
I'm sorry?
There's no doubt about that.
Yeah. Yeah, and so where things are happening really is more in the private sector. And one of the things that I'm seeing this with, for example, I read recently about there are these institutes now where people can go to where they combine like somebody who's like an angel investor and someone who doesn't want to go to college, but wants to learn how to, you know, somebody who wants to be like the next Steve Jobs and, you know, develop some, they have some idea for some technology, and they put them together with the people that they can get the knowledge they need from and the kind of people who might invest in them instead of going to college. Well, that's a very creative way of approaching that. And I would love to see science become like that again. I'm only seeing it mainly in the tech sector.
Well, that's true. Well, now, when you started doing this and then you went public with it, how did your colleagues react?
It's very interesting. My colleagues who knew me said to me, well, Diane, if you believe in this, then I'm going to give it a look. And in fact, Johns Hopkins Medical School's magazine, their alumni magazine, actually did a review of my book in it. And so I've had various doctors and scientists who have really become fascinated by the work that I do. And in fact, I've even had emails from people asking me how can I do this work. And so I've been well received by many people, but what I've run into is the people who don't take the time to try to find out what I'm actually saying, who just go by the name of my book, or who just go by, you know, what they see the topic is, and already say, no, this isn't true.
It's too far out for most people, isn't it?
Yeah, it's too far out. So I would say that the ones who are already just, you know, so turned off by the idea that they wouldn't even read the book or listen to the interview, then of course you can't have much success with them. But I think that the timing is shifting, and I mean, I know that Dr. Oz has said that he thinks that there's something to these phenomena, and there's become more and more of a an acceptance in the general public, and I think that what happens is over time that changes what we think is possible. I mean, look today at how many devices we have that are right out of Star Trek.
Oh yeah, it's amazing. Or Dick Tracy.
Yeah, or Dick Tracy, exactly.
Or the Jetsons. Remember that? No, you were too young for that.
I'm still waiting for my Rosie.
Flat screen TVs put on the wall. They had that in general. Everybody laughed at that.
I know.
And here they are.
I know. Exactly. And so what I'm saying is that our sci-fi, you know, genre has really focused on technological changes, hasn't really focused so much on, you know, our capacity as human beings, although to some extent it has, but it's put it more in terms of, like Star Trek, these are beings from another planet or whatever, but didn't put it in terms of human terms. And so I think that as you have the popular media creating, you know, more and more of these movies and more people saying, you know, no, it's possible. You know, I believe that's possible. What's happening is that more and more people are having these experiences. I've actually had some people who had never had any experience at all until they read my book, and then all of a sudden they started having
it. It kicked in, yeah. Well, that, you know what? That happens. They become more tuned up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, yeah. Whether they meditate or whatever, but that's exactly what happens. We're with Diane Hennessy-Powell, of course, her book, The ESP Enigma, her website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Are you glad you took this path?
am I glad I took this
Kind of a loaded path. Question.
Yes, I was going to say that's a very loaded question. It's had its moments. Let me say that. It has had its moments when I have said, you know, this is, it's been it's kind of the hero's journey, you know, the archetype of the hero's journey.
Yeah.
And so, yes, there have been times when I really have felt like Frodo.
I mean, can you go back to traditional psychiatry, or has that hurt that?
Well, what happened to me, I'll tell you what happened to me.
Let's hold on. We're going to hit this break, Diane, and then let's come back and get that story. We're going to talk about ESP tonight. Later on, we'll take some of the phone calls from you, stories and questions. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, for you Coast Insiders, my colleague John B. Wells will be chatting. That'll be on Wednesday night, 8 p.m. Pacific time, so make sure you're part of that and have some fun. By the way, have you seen our television program yet? Beyond Belief, you can. It's 10 days free. Take advantage of that. And all the videos that you'll be able to find, simply go to our website, coasttocoastam.com, click hosts, and then click the TV show, and there you go. And sign up, 10 days free. And welcome back with Dr. Diane Hennessy-Powell. Diane, we were talking about your ability to go back into psychiatry, and you were going to tell us a story about that, I think.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Well, it's interesting. I wrote this book actually I took a little bit of time off to write the book, and then I started practicing psychiatry again. And I knew that in publishing the book that there were scientists that I was putting at risk, thinking ill of me. I knew that was a distinct possibility.
Yeah, of course.
But I didn't really ever think about my medical career. I've always been very highly regarded as a doctor. And so what happened is that I received a letter from the medical board. I live in Oregon now, and I received a letter from the medical board and that they were opening up an investigation on me. And to make a long story short, they wanted me to see a psychiatrist, but wouldn't tell me why. And I put two and two together, and I figured that it was probably because of the fact that I wrote a book about ESP. And they probably, found it on the web. And so I went and I met with this psychiatrist for about 5 hours, and she interviewed me, and she wrote a letter to the board saying that I was insane. This is what she wrote. She basically said I was insane and therefore a danger to practice psychiatry, but she admits in the letter that she couldn't find any evidence of that. But because I'm a psychiatrist and because I have a high IQ, I would know how to answer all of the questions so that I would appear sane. She had never read the book. Nobody on the board had ever read the book. She sent the letter, and the board revoked my license on an emergency basis for 3 months. And so I had to prove that I was sane and underwent a lot of testing. And she suggested that maybe I had a brain tumor. And I underwent all that testing. I flew through it with fine colors, no mental illness. I don't have a history of mental illness. The irony is,
how bizarre.
Why I wrote this. Part of why I wrote this book was because of the stigma that these phenomena have, that people assume that someone has mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
The psychiatrists need to understand that, no, that's not the case.
And that's the first thing they think of.
Yes. So this was in 2010. My book came out late 2008, beginning of 2009. And so this happened to me in 2010. And so I got my license restored within 3 months. And my practice is full. I have a really good reputation. The board has received so many letters on my behalf telling them about what kind of doctor I am that they now think highly of me.
Isn't that something? You went through all that?
Yeah. That's why I say, it reminded me of the hero's journey. You have your moments when you're just like, and why me? But I realized that it's actually it's probably a good thing that happened from the standpoint that I proved that I'm sane and I got my license back.
Well, you shouldn't have to have proved it, but I'm glad you did.
I shouldn't have had to have, but it gives me that much more of a, fire in my belly now.
Well, it also makes you a little more sensitive of other people, I think.
Yeah, although I'm always sensitive.
You always were.
Yeah.
Right? You always were. But, I mean, it just makes it even, it magnifies it.
Oh, I had no idea. I had no idea that I was as vulnerable as I was. I had no idea that a medical board could do something like that.
Oh, my God, they could destroy you.
Yeah. And I just had no idea that, California, which is where I practiced before Oregon, in California, at UCLA, you have Judith Orloff, somebody who...
That's right. She's been on many times.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, she's on faculty at UCLA. I mean, I just...
We seem to have a lot of guests who've been probed and tested.
Uh-huh.
Maybe it's the show. I'm not sure. Maybe it's me. But let's talk about the work, the ESP, the enigma, the psychic powers, what might be out there. How does it start? How do we tap into it? Why do we tap into it? We both know we do. Everybody does. What is it?
Yeah. I think that most people do. I think the people who don't are extremely analytical. And I think that that's one of the reasons why they don't tap into it. And in my book, I talk about, I became interested in why is it that some people have these experiences like breathing air. I mean, they just happen all of the time. And then other people never had one and don't believe that they exist. And it's not just their belief that puts them in the way. Some people actually, they're not opposed to the idea of believing them. It just hasn't happened. And I think that their analytical mind is responsible. One of the things that autistic savants have taught us is that just think about what autism is and why an autistic savant can do what they can do. What they do is they see the world without the encumbrance of the part of our brain that's evolutionarily the newest. Okay, that part of their brain is usually compromised. And as a result, they see information in a much more, it's much more of the raw data. In other words, it's more like they're seeing the code and we see the icons on our iPad.
Right.
And so we're missing a lot of information that they see. And it's part of what makes life so challenging for them, you know, because they're so sensitive. They get overstimulated extremely, extremely easily. But it's like they're seeing the order of the universe. They're actually seeing it, they're experiencing it in some way. And I'm using the word seeing, but it could be coming through any sense. I mean, to give you some examples of some of the skills that these people have, and it's because they don't think conceptually. See, when you have an artistic savant who is artistic, you know, what they do is they're drawing three-dimensional objects, three-dimensional beings, horses galloping. You know, when they're 3 years old, when other children are drawing more kind of, you know, little balloons,
stick figures,
right?
Like that,
yeah. They're actually drawing what they see, whereas drawing the stick like figure is more of a conceptual way of drawing. It's not drawing what you actually see. That's that whole, you know, draw through the right side of your brain kind of thing. And so it's true for so many things with people who have the savant syndrome, is that they have such an undistorted, in some ways, undistorted perception of certain things. They have perfect pitch, a lot of them. That's one of the things that makes them such amazing musicians. They have a lot of them have such incredible memories that they can't forget anything, and they have this ability to detect order in ways that we can't pick it up. One of the stories that I like is of Leslie Lemke, who's a blind savant, who's a musical savant, and he was born with cerebral palsy, and he was born. He actually had to have his eyes removed. He was blind, and he was orphaned. And this nurse adopted him, and he couldn't even stand till he was 14 years old. And he started walking when he was 15. And she used to play classical music, and when one day she was in her bedroom and all of a sudden she heard Tchaikovsky, you know, Concerto No. 1 playing, and she thought, you know, she said, did I leave, you know, some music on? And he was playing it.
Now, is this paranormal or is this natural?
Is this, well, see, I don't like the word paranormal because I think that, I don't think any laws are violated. I just think that we don't know all of the laws.
Well, that's possible.
Yeah, I just think that we don't know all of the, we
it
don't
was
know
always
all
there.
Of the rules of the universe.
Right.
You know,
and
you know,
because we don't know it, we label it as such, you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. We don't know, you know, so obviously because it's happening, it's not defying, you know, the rules of the universe. We just don't understand it yet. And so, but in terms of, that's the question that I ask. I'm interested in, there are savants who have incredible memories. They have an incredible ability to pick up order.
Can they do telepathy?
That's the part I'm interested in. And yes, many of them can. Absolutely. Absolutely. They can do telepathy, precognition. They can.
Easier than non-savants?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, each one of these savants that that I've talked to, when I talk with the family, you hear stories about the ESP. You'll hear the stories about, for example, this one savant that I saw in India. His father was talking about how she likes food a lot, and he's trying to keep her from gaining weight, and so he'll buy food and. He'll just give her some, but she'll know that she'll know exactly, you know, what he's hiding from her. That there's more left,
and she'll get it,
huh?
And she'll find it.
Yeah, and she'll find it exactly. And similarly, they'll tell me about telepathic experiences because this girl, she's mute. She doesn't talk. And so her primary way of communicating is telepathically.
Do you think savants telepathically can communicate with each other that way?
I don't think anybody's ever tried that. I don't think anybody's ever tried that.
An interesting test.
It'd be very interesting. It'd be very interesting to do. Yes, it'd be very interesting to do. I mean, savants, when it depends upon the autistic savant, how functional they are and how capable they are of you know, interacting with other people. But there are definitely some savants that have, through their abilities, they've been able to, people like Daryl Trefford, who wrote Islands of Genius, he's studied autistic savants for 50 years, and he has told me, you know, stories of people that he calls it training to the talent, if you find the thing that they're really, really good at, and they see that people praise them for it and they get recognition for it. It really helps them to come out, and a lot of them can live fairly normal lives.
The fact, do they have any similarities between each other where you could say, you know what, this is a trait?
Well, I mean, the fact that they have lots of things in common, you know, but just because of the fact that they're autistic and they're savants, so they have a lot of things in common. Is there something in particular that you're thinking about?
Well, I mean, you know, like we were talking about the telepathy, of which there have been no tests.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, can they move objects or anything like that with their minds?
They, I haven't met anyone who can do that. No, I haven't met anyone who can do psychokinesis. No. But on the other hand, kind of interesting, this one savant, you could think of it as being something sort of along those lines. This one savant, it's either precognition or something like that, because there are teachers at school that he likes and he doesn't like, and he would announce, you know, that to his parents, he'd say, oh, so-and-so is going to get a promotion. And the person, the teacher themselves wouldn't even know it. But then, lo and behold, a couple of weeks later, it gives a prize promotion. Or he'd say, oh, so-and-so is going to get transferred. And oh, no way, so-and-so is going to get transferred. And then so-and-so would get transferred. So it's kind of interesting. I mean, is that precognition or is somehow his stating something like that playing a role in it coming about? I mean,
how much of this, Diane, do you think consciousness plays a role?
Oh, I think consciousness is everything. Yeah.
How so?
Well, just then I drink water.
Okay, get a drink.
Yeah. How so? I was just thinking of that politician that took a drink during the
Rubio.
Yes, Rubio.
It wouldn't have been half as bad if the drink was next to it. But I mean, he had to like reach almost off camera to come back and get it. Yeah. Always keep your drink by you so you can reach for it.
Mine's right by me.
That's right.
Everything has to do with consciousness. I'm fascinated by the whole concept of what is consciousness. And people have been debating this for, as long as people have been, recording history.
Well, and is it part of the brain or is it outside of the brain?
See, I think of consciousness as being something that is, I agree with people like William James who see the brain as something that processes consciousness rather than generating it. And the reason I say that is because of the really compelling stories, the near-death experience stories that people have documented, and the most famous being the Pam Reynolds case, which I'm sure you've heard
yes.
many times on your show.
I sure have.
And so I think there's lots of evidence, and then Ian Stevenson's work as well. I mean, there's lots of evidence out there that suggests that consciousness isn't something that is part and parcel of our brain. And
because there's a camp out there, Diane, a lot of people think that if the brain dies, everything goes.
I know.
I happen to think everything continues.
Right.
That the brain might be a vehicle, but it's not a necessity.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah, I see the brain as being it's really our way of processing, information, and it filters information, it selects information, and it puts it together in a certain way for us to process.
We're going to come back in a moment, Diane. We're going to take phone calls for you and also stories, perhaps. On ESP Experiences. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.